So our passage for today is the story of the Garden of Gethsemane. It's a passage that's quite familiar to many of us, especially if you've been to church for a while. And it's a passage that is sort of odd to have on Palm Sunday. Palm Sunday normally is the day that you have the sermon of the triumphal entry, you know, where Jesus comes into Jerusalem on a donkey, right, on a colt. And I know in the Sunday school they're teaching that right now today because it is Palm Sunday. But the passage that we have is found not on the Sunday of that week, but on the Thursday of that week. It is a day often called Maundy Thursday. It's a day that Jesus has his last supper with his friends, his disciples, and he also washes their feet. And then we turn to this passage, which happens right immediately after this happens. In which Jesus goes to the Garden of Gethsemane to pray. And the verse immediately following this, Judas comes into the picture and he betrays his master. So this here is a really crucial story because this is the day before Jesus is crucified. This is a very crucial story in the week of Holy Week. This is also a really interesting story because it doesn't involve all the disciples. I don't know if you noticed this, but it doesn't involve all the disciples. It only involves three of the disciples, Peter, James, and John. And these are kind of like his Jesus' inner circle, if you will, right? The closest of his disciples. And these three disciples are also the three disciples that show up with Jesus at the Transfiguration, right? So they witness the Transfiguration of Jesus. So this height of this foretaste of Jesus' glory. And here in this passage, it's a bit of a different story being told. Peter, we know, is really important, obviously, you know, in early church and time again, he comes up as really important in the Gospels. But James and John, they're also really important. They're the disciples that in other Gospels, you have them so close to Jesus that they're debating which one should sit on the right hand and on the left hand, right? You remember that those passages, right? So these are the inner circle for Jesus. But what is this passage mainly about? I was thinking about this, and I was thinking, you know, why are there these three disciples and Jesus? You know, is it like the Taylor Swift concert? Okay, sorry, this was in my mind. I don't know why, but is it like a Taylor Swift concert, and you have an opening act, okay, or maybe a backup singers and backup band, right, that supports on the sidelines, okay? Or is it that this is a team project? You know, many of us in school or at work, you know, we have these team projects. You ever, you know, I hated team projects. I always hate team projects. You know, they're supposed to build collaboration and goodness, right? But, you know, they're kind of annoying also because somebody is inevitably doing more work than the other people, right? You know, so what is happening here, right, with this group? Why are these four people together? And why is Jesus picking his inner circle to be here with him at the Garden of Gethsemane? Now, there's a couple things that we could observe from this passage. Very, very early in this passage, we have this idea where Jesus invites his friends to be with him in the Garden of Gethsemane. And he says, you know, in verse 36, well, you sit here while I go over there and pray. Okay? We don't know what is happening aside from there to sit there while he goes away to pray. But it says in verse 37 that as Jesus was praying, he began to be sorrowful and troubled. And then 38, He says to them, my soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. Stay here and keep watch with me. This passage opens up and it really highlights this idea that Jesus is really distraught. He's really sad, if you will, almost to the point of being incapacitated, basically dead in the sense of not even being able to function. I don't know if you've ever felt anything like that before. I think for myself, I felt something quite similar when I lost my father. I think when I lost my father, I felt so overwhelmed with emotions that it made it very difficult for me to even think or make choices in life. You know, have you been distraught like this? Have you been overwhelmed like this? We're not actually told what Jesus is specifically praying about. We know the words that he's praying, right? And he's praying about this cup and letting it pass. In the Old Testament, the idea of a cup represents judgment. Okay, that the removal of this cup is a removal of judgment. So here, Jesus seems to be praying about this judgment that he feels he's expecting with his pending death on the cross and the weight of the world's sins upon his shoulders. So for Jesus, his feeling of sadness, of depression, is immense. And that's why in verse 37, it says, in the NIV, it says that he was sorrowful and troubled. And these words are really interesting because the word sorrow here is translated in different ways, but it's really this idea of this deep sadness, this sense of depression almost, that is caused by, you know, probably this knowledge that God has asked him to do something that's really hard to do. But this idea of being troubled is this idea of kind of anxiety, irritation. There's something that's going to happen and you don't want to do it. You know, you ever feel that way? You know, there's something that's going to happen and you don't want to experience it. You know, I just thought about Noam and her vivas coming up. I don't know if you want to have your examination for your PhD, but you know, it's like this sense of, I might be putting feelings into her. Hopefully I don't. But you know, when you have a big exam coming up, theoretically, you know, out there, if you have a big exam coming up or some really important thing that's coming up, right? There, you're filled oftentimes with anxiety, with an irritation, because it's like, am I going to do it right? Am I going to do it well? Am I going to do it well enough? Can I do it? And here you have Jesus in such a distressful moment. He's sorrowful. He's troubled. He's depressed and he's anxious. But then we have this interesting exchange between Jesus and the disciples. Jesus is annoyed at the disciples. You know, for the longest time, whenever I read this passage, I was like, well, why is Jesus annoyed at the disciples, right? He just told them, go sit here. I'm going to go over there. I was like, well, what are they supposed to do, right? And it's like, watch and, you know, wait here and watch. You know, take guard. It's like, so what's going on, you know? And for the longest time, I thought that what Jesus was saying to them was, watch out because there's some guards, there's some soldiers are going to come, right? Which happens later on in this passage, right? But really, what we have is that if we look closer and we look at verse 41, for instance, it says, watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Here is such a really interesting statement that Jesus makes. Watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. It is this idea that for Jesus, it's not just for you to sit there, but it's for you to sit there and watch and pray. What do you mean watch and pray? Watch with Jesus and pray alongside with Jesus. What we have here is not simply that Jesus is annoyed at his disciples for being tired or, you know, I don't know, have you ever, you know, tried praying and falling asleep, right? You know, is that why Jesus is annoyed? Because you didn't have enough sleep when you were praying or what, you know? No, that's not what's happening here. Jesus is annoyed because this is a time in which he is really struggling. This is a time when Jesus is struggling and he needs to not be alone. He was alone, but he didn't want to be alone. And for the disciples, and perhaps for us, one of the big takeaways, I think, is that we are to be there, present for others, especially when people are going through difficult times. And we are to have greater empathy, that we are to ask God for greater empathy for those in great need, to support those in need. It's not saying that we need to have the right words or the right things to do to fix the problems, but to support and to be there praying alongside one another. And there's something here in this passage that it says about prayer. Verse 41, again, is such a key verse. Because Jesus says here, watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. So first we have this idea of keeping watch and praying so that the why? So that disciples don't fall into temptation. This is actually it's interesting because it reminds me of how Jesus taught his disciples to pray, right? You know the Lord's Prayer, lead us not into temptation, right? But deliver us from evil. You know, the prayer for Jesus seems to be an antidote, if you will, a way to address temptations. But also, there's this very famous line here. It's even an English idiom now. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. And I think this is a really interesting phrase for multiple reasons. But one of the things is that I think we need to realize that here, this verse is not saying that there is necessarily a battle between our flesh and our spirit. Okay. During the Greco-Roman period, there's a lot of religions of the day, and one of them was held this dichotomy between our material bodies and our spiritual our spirits, that our material bodies are evil almost, and our spirit was good. And I think oftentimes in Christian circles in the church, we often actually kind of treat Christianity like that, in which we think, well, you know, everything's spiritual, and so nothing in this world should matter. We shouldn't care about the material. We shouldn't care about this world. But rather for Jesus, he's underscoring this idea that the flesh is points to our human weakness, especially in our mortality, our mortal bodies. While our spirit includes our feelings, our thinkings, and our willings that can be moved to do what is harmonious in line with God's plan. In a way, it underscores to you that you know, oftentimes sin comes from our desire to kind of preserve ourselves. You know, we're tempted to lie, cheat, and steal because we're trying to preserve ourselves. We're trying to protect what we have that is temporary in this world. But here in this passage, we see this tension within Jesus' statement between the spirit that can be willing to follow after God, but the flesh that is so weak and is able to be tempted. We see this, of course, in the first temptation of Jesus, just after his baptism. When the devil taunts Jesus at the moment when his flesh was so weak, after 40 days of fasting and praying. So his flesh was weak, and that was the moment that the devil taunts Jesus. So if prayer is a kind of antidote to temptations, it is because through prayer, we are connected to God's Spirit, who in turn empowers our spirit to overcome our fleshly weaknesses. But sadly, of course, in the story, we see how Jesus' three friends, his closest friends, the ones that he chose to be with him at his greatest moment of need, they have let their fleshly weariness overcome their friends' needs. They fall prey to the temptation of the devil. But interestingly, Jesus doesn't give up on them. That's why in verses 43 and 44, he doesn't actually wake them up when they're asleep. He doesn't scold them. Because he knows this tension that exists between the flesh and the spirit. But what's striking, I think, of this passage is that here, it is not just the disciples who are weak in the flesh. It is also Jesus. Jesus isn't just saying to the disciples, your spirit is willing, your flesh is weak. Rather, he's saying it in a very generic sense, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Jesus himself is in turmoil. He prays and he faces temptation, and he wants his friends to watch and pray to accompany him because he knows he's being tempted. But the phrase, the spirit is willing, the flesh is weak, is not just to the disciples, but is also to himself. We see this very clearly in his prayers. Because he's asking God, what is he asking God? He's asking God to take away this cup, to take away this judgment. His own spirit knows God's will, but his flesh does not want to follow that path. So even Jesus, the Son of God, the promised Messiah, whose entire mission has been pointed to this climactic point, even this Jesus experiences the weakness of the flesh, the distress, the troubles, the sorrows, and the anxiety. As we are in Palm Sunday, we are reminded again that this is a Holy Week. This is the beginning of a week that points towards Good Friday. We are reminded of this story on Maundy Thursday, the day in which Jesus celebrated a final meal with his friends, washed their feet, and then prayed with his closest three friends in the Garden of Gethsemane. We are reminded of the heavy weight of our own sin and the great love and grace of God, who sent his Son so that we can overcome sin and death. And so we are reminded of our own dependence on God and the pain inflicted on Jesus on our account. But moreover, this passage reminds us how easily our fleshes are tempted by Satan, even if our spirits are focused and willing to follow our God. I was thinking as I was preparing this sermon, how much, you know, for myself, you know, there, I'm often tempted to yield to my flesh than to my spirit. When I know what it is that God wants of me, and I just don't want to do it. You know, sometimes it's apathy, sometimes it's tiredness, sometimes it's just something else is more alluring. And yet, God here, through Jesus, reminds us of the challenges in life that pulls us away, whether it's the depth of agony and despair, the demands of our day-to-day, they tear us away from God's path. So I want to ask you, are there some in our midst who are going through hardship or in need of extra strength in our spirits, despite our weaknesses in flesh? God is here and is before you. And I'm reminded of Matthew 7, where Jesus says, "Ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened to you." Or perhaps for some of us, everything is happy-go-lucky. Not a problem in the world. But that doesn't mean that God doesn't have something for you. And perhaps God is inviting us also to be like Peter, James, and John. Well, not be like Peter, James, and John. To be following after the invitation that was extended to Peter, James, and John. To be called to support the friend in need through being present, keeping watch, and being in prayer. And we need to ask God for greater empathy for those in need. Now, I'm going to switch gears now and end the sermon here. And we're going to go into a different moment now. We're going to go into a time for prayer. Perhaps if you could find two or three people in the congregation, we're going to spend some time supporting one another and praying. Maybe somebody that you don't live with. because maybe you need to pray about that. No, I'm just kidding. we'll have a few minutes for prayer. Find two or three, you know, people to be with, and then I'll end us in prayer, and then, yeah.